That's right. We're here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. Hey, I'm Ann Eller, 407 in the afternoon. Today, we have a real treat for you. We have Chris Allen, who writes under the name Israel Allen. He's the author of two novels and several plays. He's a Lander professor, and he's here to talk today to us. So how you doing today, Chris Allen?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Gosh, you know, your latest play actually went very well, didn't it?
I thought so. I was very pleased. We ended up with a great cast and really wonderful audience response. I couldn't have been happier with the performances that we got. It was a nice run. It was a very nice run.
Nice run. And, of course, this the last play was, Some Other Context, right?
Some Other Context.
Yes, it was about a young minister.
Yes, actually, it's kind of a funny story. I was over the summer. I was in Montreat. I don't know if you're aware of Montreat, but in any case, worked with a lot of young college students. One of whom, a good guy named Will Wilson, who was studying to be a pastor, and he and I were in a restaurant with a couple of other friends, and he just went gaga over the girl behind the counter. And so I tried to get him to ask her out. He would not do so, but we later joked about
story.
This is the real story. This is how we started this process.
Okay.
So you know, we were just badgering poor Will to go ask this girl out, and he just wouldn't do it. And so as the conversation wore on, we realized, you know, he was planning to preach that Sunday, and we thought, well, what would it be like if he looked up in the middle of his sermon and there she was? And so that became the basis of Some Other Context. The play is about a young pastor who has been badgered by a friend to ask out a girl, and unlike Will, actually goes and asks the girl out. Of course, she says no. She's a waitress. She's some stranger, and so. Then a couple of scenes later, you see him preaching his very first sermon as a proper pastor, and lo and behold, there she is in the tiny little congregation, and he loses it altogether. And so the story goes on from there about how to deal with that problem.
Absolutely. Now, actually, that's actually the clip that I saw on YouTube. There's a clip of that, yes?
Yes, yes. We had actually a nice little preview put together for us by Krista Hansen, and really appreciated that work.
Absolutely. That's great. So now, you are originally from where?
I was born in Jackson, Tennessee, but didn't live there very long, didn't live anywhere very long growing up.
Because?
My father was a minister of music, music and youth in churches, and so we moved around all the time. We lived in seven different towns by the time I was seven. And then lived in
one a year,
roughly. Although some less than a year, some a little more. It was quite chaotic. But we lived in that seventh town for almost 7 years, which is a very strange experience for me. Clinton, Tennessee, lived there for almost 7 years, and by the time we left, I was wondering, you know, when are we going to get out of here? I loved Clinton; it was a wonderful place to live, but had become so accustomed to moving around that it was just a very strange experience to be there for so long.
The idea to have a long-term relationship with friends
with
and everything,
anyone at all, but, it's just not the way it works. So anyhow, and that has sort of continued. I've lived in quite a few cities since then. We moved from there, lived in Pulaski, Tennessee while I was in high school, and then went back to Jackson for college. My father and I are both Union University grads.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, when I was a child, I had all sorts of ideas about what I would, you know, be when I grew up. For a while, I wanted to be an architect and used to draw house plans and building plans and things of this nature. But by the time I was, you know, middle school age, I had decided that I would be a minister. In large part, I realized years later that this was not really a product of a calling as such, but a product of being a good speaker and somebody who knew the Bible well. And so everybody wanted me to talk about it, and it became a lot of pressure to ultimately become a pastor. And so I stayed on that path for a long time. And after about 2 years of being a youth minister, I realized this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. It would be going differently if this was what I was supposed to be doing. And so sort of stepped back from that and took a couple of years to figure out what I wanted to do with my life.
Well, now I understand that you actually love Asheville, North Carolina.
I think love is a mild term
mild
for my
term,
relationship
okay.
with Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
I I went to Asheville for the first time in 1989, right before my 15th birthday, on a church trip, actually. We went to Ridgecrest, what's now Ridgecrest Conference Center. It had a longer, more complicated name in those days. But in any case, spent a week there and just loved those mountains, loved that community. And so as a finishing up my freshman year in college, went back to work at Ridgecrest and did that for 3 summers in college. And just loved Asheville, loved every minute of it. And later when I was in grad school, I worked at Montreat Conference Center in the summers and just spent as much time as I possibly can in that area. I've never actually been able to live there full time, but spend as much of my free time as I can there. I was there last Wednesday hanging out with some friends there, and we'll be back on Saturday. It's sort of bedrock to who I am and how I think now.
Yeah, you know, Asheville, if you were there in 1989, that time period, certainly has changed since that time frame.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and I still love it, and I don't mean to complain, but it used to be a lot more fun in a lot of ways. It's become sort of yuppified over the last 10 years or so. The Charlotte bankers seem to have figured out how wonderful it was, and they'd moved in force. And so the community has changed quite a lot, but it's still one of the most wonderful places in the world, and I wouldn't trade it.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful, but it has certainly grown from what it was back in the late 80s, early 90s. But how did you end up in Greenwood?
Job.
Job.
Very simple.
J-O-B?
Yes. I have a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Southern Illinois University, and when I graduated, the market is just flooded. With English professors, they're, you know, I often jokingly say we're a dime a dozen. I hope that what we do is worth a little bit more than that. But in terms of, you know, job market availability, it is incredibly difficult. I applied for a lot of jobs, and at, you know, without bragging, had a relatively nice resume and done public relations before I went back to grad school, and you know, had a pretty good resume and could not find a job. The job that I found was at Piedmont Tech. And so I came to teach at Piedmont Tech and was very glad to have the job, and they treated me very well. But ultimately, Lander offered me a position and have gone over there, and they've treated me very, very well as well. And so I have no complaints about my work here, but that's how I got here.
Now, what did you teach? What are you teaching over at Lander? What range there?
I teach a little bit of different things. We all teach composition, of course, sort of the bedrock of any English department.
How do you find the students coming into 101 English or whatever it would be called? Go ahead, say it.
Yeah, I am troubled by the lack of preparation, and I don't blame the students for that. I blame our culture and our educational system prior to that, and I don't mean to disparage our K-12 teachers, because I think most of them are doing a wonderful job with what they have to work with. But the reality is the writing capabilities when they show up in college is rarely what it should be when they show up in college. And so we deal with that on a daily basis, trying to fix those things while also doing what you're supposed to learn in college. And it's, you know, this is not unique to Lander or to South Carolina. This is a national situation. Having taught now 4 different colleges in different states, this is the reality of life in America. In large part, I would argue, because of sort of the diminishing literary capacity of our culture. We used to be a reading people, I think, and are less and less a reading people and more a phone and television people. That has an impact.
Absolutely.
So we're losing some of our written language skill as a culture.
Well, that's kind of scary. Hey, you know what? We're going to be back here. We're here with Chris Allen here today. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to pick up this. And what about texting and all that stuff that is just ruining English, as those of us who grew up with English knew? Hey, don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
All right, we're here with Chris Allen. He is a Lander professor and writes plays and novels, and he's here sitting with me today. We are talking about the English language. We just had started this conversation, Chris, about what is happening with the English language. We've got people that I think a lot of young people have a difficult time having a true conversation without all the electronic devices to help them through it.
It's definitely becoming a huge problem in our culture, and we were just discussing this in the break that I had originally thought when I witnessed these young people texting back and forth that they were using a sort of standardized method of communication that made sense to them, and even though I might not understand it, you know, maybe I'm just too old, and I shouldn't worry that much about it because they're able to communicate. But I discovered that often they are not communicating at all. I had the interesting experience of being in the dressing room at Greenwood Community Theater, where there were a number of children backstage during a show, and they were texting back and forth, which is an interesting phenomenon in and of itself, that they
right.
would be texting each other even though they were in the same room and could speak, choosing to text rather than to actually speak. But what fascinated me, what sort of opened my eyes to the problem with this stuff, was when I realized that they were texting with abbreviations that the receiver could not understand and then had to text back to get clarification. And because they were in the same room, I was able to witness students saying, you know, looking up from the phone and going, what do you mean? What is this? I don't understand this. And so it's very troubling that we're sort of having this de-evolution of language. You know, languages change. Words
sure.
don't necessarily mean what they meant 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But if you can still communicate to an individual, we can live with that. That's the natural course of a language. But when a language starts falling apart such that, you know, a native speaker can no longer communicate with another native speaker, that's a real problem. I worry about where we're going. I try not to worry too much, but it's definitely a part of the society that we live in.
Well, and that has to be an issue when you're dealing with students that are coming in to college, and you were talking about dealing with composition and everything. What is a sentence?
Well,
when you look at texts and they're just three words or something short and abbreviated?
Luckily, they're not that bad in an official paper ever. I used to get, when I first started teaching in Illinois, I haven't had this in South Carolina. I think maybe students have been broken of this habit, but I used to get a lot of text and what I thought of it in those days as IM speak in papers in Illinois. I haven't seen that here in South Carolina, thankfully. So we've made some improvement over the last few years as far as that sort of stuff goes. And I should say, you know, I realize that many of the students who are not writing that well are doing so because they simply haven't been taught to, and that's part of the job of professors like me to go ahead and let them know, hey, these are the problems that you're having. Let's try to get those sorted out before you get out into the real world and it starts to cost you in a very real way. And so many of the students are open to that and want to learn and grow. And so that's one of the more rewarding things is when you have those students who show up clearly unprepared for college, but with a little teaching and a whole lot of student effort, by the end of a year, they're able to do most of these things reasonably well. And hopefully by the time they graduate, they're where they belong on that scale. We'll see. I hope that we're having the impact that we're trying to have.
Now, I was looking at your what all you teach, and one of the things you teach is business communications. How's that one working?
Well,
as a business person here, how's that one working, Chris?
We have the same sorts of problems, particularly with grammar and so forth. But I find that class to be very rewarding in that, when you're teaching written composition, everybody has to take that. And some people want to be there and some people do not. But when you're teaching business communication, nearly all of the students recognize this is going to matter. I need to be able to do a reasonably good resume. I need to be able to produce a grammatically correct business letter in order to not embarrass myself when trying to get a job or on the job. I need to be able to do this efficiently and avoid being fired. And so the student investment goes up in that class versus some of the other things that we sometimes teach. Because obviously the written composition is something that everyone needs. Literally everyone needs to be able to communicate effectively in written language.
Regardless of what
but
they're
in. But it can be difficult sometimes to communicate that in a way to a student to cause buy-in, to make the student believe this is really important. It's less difficult in a business communication class to make that connection between what I am teaching you and what your real life is going to look like when you graduate from college. And so that's sure. a fun class for me.
Now, you also teach writing poetry and writing the one-act play. As students at Lander, what are you seeing? How is the level of ability to create?
Well, I have not yet taught the playwriting class at Lander. I taught that class actually at North Greenville this past semester. I was driving up there one night a week to teach that and teaching the poetry at Lander. And I have to say I was very impressed. I was very happy with the quality of the creative writing of my students. Really blown away by some of them. I had a handful of students in that poetry class who were just amazing poets, who blew me away every week when they turned in their work, and that was incredibly rewarding. And my playwriting students at North Greenville were also very impressive. There were 11 students in that class, and all of them produced what I would think was quality work by the end of the semester, and some of them really amazing work. And so we're getting some good stuff out of South Carolina these days. I'm pleased with the level of creativity.
What are the things that students are interested in when you talk about the creative writing process and poetry? What are they interested in, though?
It differs from student to student. Some students are dealing with their own lives. Of course, college is a time when you sort of figure out who you are and who you want to be, and much of the creativity is growing out of, the creative writing grows out of those experiences prior. What have they dealt with their families and their siblings and friends and their communities? Particularly, at Lander, we have students who come out of not the best neighborhoods in Columbia sometimes, and so they have, that background, and they're trying to process that as they grow. Others, have wonderful family situations but have dealt with other issues and so forth. You're getting all of that. And so a lot of the creative work grows out of those foundational experiences of the individual, and so that becomes part of it. Obviously, relationships are part of writing. No matter how old you are, people write about their romantic relationships.
Don't tell me.
We start doing that at age 12 and continue until 120 if we're still working.
Yes. Well, what about the effect of social media? What do you think social media is doing with the creative writing with that? How do you think that's affecting it?
In some ways, it's a horrible thing because it opens up the market for work of no quality whatsoever. On the other hand, it's a wonderful thing because it opens up connections between people who would have no other connection at all. One of the things I've been fascinated to observe over the last 3 years, we were discussing John Green briefly a little while ago, is a young adult writer that a friend introduced me to. And he has this huge following of teenagers all over the country who are connecting over the internet, and, mm-hmm. and they write things, they produce posters and little videos, and they write songs, and they're creating all this stuff, often collaboratively. There was a poster that he posted online where part of it had been designed by a person in the American South, I forget where, and the other collaborating partner on the initial version of it came from New York, and then a person in Europe had been coming in and adding some stuff at the end, and so the final product was a collaboration between people in three very different parts of the world, and it was this beautiful piece of artwork that's created. And so
that's pretty fascinating.
We have this broad spectrum that's mm-hmm. available to us, and so I try not to get caught up in the bad and focus on the good, because there is a lot of good that's coming out of these kinds of things. As we, I think, hinted at earlier, sometimes the social media prevent people from having one-on-one interactions face-to-face. It can be difficult for people. I think it feeds some of that. People who are naturally shy maybe have anxiety issues. They don't have opportunity to overcome them because they're able to sort of hide in social media and not interact in real life. So it can be a problem, but it can also be a very wonderful thing for cross-cultural pollination of creativity.
Cross-pollinization of creativity. What a phrase. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with Chris Allen. We are going to hear South Carolina news, a word from our sponsors. If you've got a question for Chris, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. Right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with Chris Allen this afternoon. Chris Allen is a professor at Lander University. He's also a playwright, a novelist, and we're talking about his books. We're going to talk about his books a little bit. We're also going to talk some more about the plays that he's done. And who knows where this conversation will lead. So here, you stay right with us right here on WCRS. Don't forget, you can always listen to us on the stream at our website, WCRS1450AM.net. So check that out. By the way, if you have to step away, you will be able to get a podcast of this event right here this afternoon, and there will be a video on YouTube. So how about that? So Chris, see, you can share this with everybody.
Sharing with the world.
There you go.
The joy of social media, yeah, exactly. As we were discussing just a little while ago.
Exactly. But you've written a couple of books.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about them.
Two that are available to the public. I've actually written a couple of others. I'm still revising, trying to make worthy of being read. But
right.
The first novel is a piece called Anachronistic in Asheville, which is probably the stupidest title you'll ever hear in your life. I don't know what I was thinking when I chose to call it that. But
what does it mean, Chris?
Anachronistic. That's the problem, is that very few of us know what that word means at all. I don't know what I was thinking. Anachronistic means out of place in time. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually a novel in stories. Small little anecdotes from 23 different narrators over the course of about a year and a half, covering the main arc of the story. It's a novel and story, so you have the one sort of long arc. Mm-hmm. It's actually a sort of a romantic comedy about this guy named Jeff Long and this girl Dana Tate, who meet in the first story, and ultimately, I don't want to ruin the ending, but it has a happy ending, and so anyway, it's their story. It's their story, but told sometimes from them, but very often told sort of from a side view, where someone else is telling a story that's central to that character's
sure.
little story, but gives you a little bit more of another piece of the puzzle of how Jeff and Dana are progressing through their relationship. And so, but all of these characters are sort of old fashioned, and they don't really fit in that 90s hippie Asheville that we were talking about earlier, where it all takes place. And so, hence anachronistic in Asheville.
Any reality in the show? In that?
A lot of it is, you know, I almost never write anything where the plot itself is something that's actually occurred, but it's always rooted in those experiences. And so most of these characters are sort of amalgams of people that I knew, and you know, like what I was talking about with some other context, there's some grain of an event that really happened that then, you know, I imagine a larger version of that event, and that's what becomes the piece of fiction. So a lot of the little stories my friends that hung out with me in Asheville in the 90s would recognize very immediately, so much so that that's actually what's on the cover there. This is actually a photograph of some of my friends walking through a building under construction, and I think this was taken in 1996.
Right.
But that's the cover, sort of grasping that group effect, what it's like to be young and not entirely responsible in Asheville in the 90s. So that's anachronistic.
Oh, to be there again today.
It would be fun. I would go back to Asheville circa 1995 in a heartbeat. You know, you build the time machine and I will take the ride. It's not a problem.
What was that? Ronnie Millsap wrote a song, Lost in the 60s.
Mm.
Get lost in the 60s tonight. Yeah. Well, there you go.
I would gladly be lost in 1995. No problem.
No problem.
Yes, sign me up.
Sign me up. Beam me up, Scotty.
Bring on the TARDIS. I am ready to take the trip. So, yeah. The other novel is a piece called Homecoming King. I'm going to put that for the YouTubers, but very much a different kind of story, although they're connected. Some of the same characters sort of evolve through. Homecoming King is a tragedy. It's about a young guy who's sort of a womanizer and is sort of slowly realizing that this lifestyle is not going to yield what he wants. And we pick up the story where he's just sort of begun to understand that, and we see him beginning to get some of the things that he wanted and experiencing the tragedy of what that really looks like. And so it's not a happy story. I often get yelled at by people when they finish, why did you do this? It's nice to have the passionate response. So I know I've done that job, but it really paints a picture of where some of the choices of our culture lead you. And so that's Homecoming King.
Now, these books are available in print?
Yes, you can get that order on Amazon or from Barnes & Noble, and they're also available e-books, so you can put that on your Nook or your Kindle, and so they're readily available.
Readily available, and you'd like everybody to read them, right?
Well, sure.
Yeah, there you go.
It takes a long time. We were discussing this in the early, before we actually went on the air. I've now written four novels, and two of them are not yet out. But one of them, I wrote the first draft in 2011 and is only now nearing the point of being readable and, you know, ready for other people to look at. It takes a long time. I wrote the first draft of Anachronistic when I was in college, actually, and that took several years to sort of bang into something that I felt was ready for readers, and it took maybe 3 or 4 years to get Homecoming King in place. So it's a long process. You put a lot of time and effort and heart into these things. You'd love to have people read them.
Now, did you self-publish these?
Those two I did, yes, in part because of what we were just discussing. It's so difficult to sell something if you can't tell people what it is in one sentence. And frankly, I can't tell you what Anachronistic is in one sentence, and nobody else can either. And similarly with Homecoming King. And also, it doesn't. Homecoming King, I'm going to ruin it for you. It does not have a happy ending. It does not have a happy ending. It's a tragedy. That's the way it is. And that doesn't sell well in our culture. And it's hard to put that out there. I had a lot of editors read the book and write very nice responses about, we love these characters and we love this and we love that, but we just don't know how to sell this book. And so that's what happened. I ultimately said, okay, I'd been badgered by friends who wanted to have, something other than a Word file. Mm-hmm. And so I finally broke down and did that. And, of course, it's very easy to do now,
How do you do it?
You go on to Amazon, and they have a service called Create Space, and you build your own book. I happen to have a dear friend who's a graphic designer, a girl named Claire Hyde Kaiser. She put together the covers for me, and then just put all that into the forms that are available on Create Space, and poof, you have yourself a book.
Wow.
Works brilliantly, and really with e-books, you just put the file up, and anybody can download it. That's what I did.
That's what you did. Hey, that's pretty cool. Hey, I am here with Chris Allen. We're talking about books. We're talking about plays. When we come back, we're going to talk about a couple of his plays that did very, very well. In fact, they became the state Southeastern Theater State Conference. They were for the state. They won. We'll talk more about it when we come back. Don't you go away.
Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of...
This year will be a simpler year. One fine gift to last a lifetime from Mother Earth with love. A diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72 Greenwood, 229-6276. Oh, that's right. 4:48 in the afternoon. Hey, I'm Ann Eller here with Chris Allen, professor at Lander. He's an assistant professor of English. He also has written several plays. You may have been to them at GCT. But he's also written a play that has not been put on. He's done a play on the life of Benjamin Mays. And what can you tell us about that, Chris?
Well, it started... sort of as a new thing to me. I course, I'm not from this area, and sadly, Dr. Mays is not that well known outside of the area and the circle of people who do know who he is. And it's very disturbing now that I know all that he did and how important he was that I was not educated on this prior. But I was, of course, involved with GCT, and Lois Sarton, who is the curator of the Benjamin Mays Museum, had asked Bess Park about the possibility of putting together a play and how could we go about that. And she came to me knowing that I was writing plays. And so I took Dr. Mays' autobiography and a handful of his other books, and with reading all of those books and meeting with Loy and listening to speeches and sermons and all of this, managed to put together a stage adaptation of what I call stage adaptation of Born to Rebel, his autobiography. It includes material from some of his other works, but it's primarily based on Born to Rebel, his autobiography. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to produce it yet. We were very close last year, I believe it was, had a person lined up to come in and direct the show and also to play Dr. Mays in the show, but unfortunately the scheduling and the funding didn't quite match at the right times, and so it hasn't happened yet. But I know Loy and a lot of the other people who are part of what they call the Mays community, they all want to see that happen. I would like to see it happen, but you know, until we find the right director and the right person to play and the right timing and all of that, it just hasn't happened yet. So sure. Hopefully it will.
Absolutely. Well, that's fascinating that you've actually put that together and that it is there to play.
To do, yeah. Well, and I really want to see it come to fruition. I've been asked a couple of times, you know, will you just direct it yourself and you know, pick out some folks? And I have said no because, I've directed plays, but this is a big project and an important project. I'm about to get a little emotional. I want to be careful with Dr. Mays, and I don't think I'm qualified to direct that show. I'm just not a good enough director, and I think he deserves that.
Well, I think that would be tremendous. He certainly, the museum over there certainly has turned out quite nicely. It was quite a project to put together, and a lot of people have been here to see it. And, of course, when they had the unveiling of the whole project, there were a lot of very important dignitaries that came here to town for that.
Oh, yeah. Loy has done an amazing job with the museum. It'll blow you away. If you haven't been out there, you need to go out there. You need to see it. If you're not familiar with the life and work of Dr. Benjamin Mays, you need to become so as quickly as you can.
Absolutely. You know, I was telling you before that Herman Cain was a graduate, 1967 graduate from Morehouse College, and actually that was Benjamin Mays' last year. He retired that year. It was the 100th anniversary of Morehouse College, and it also was the only year that he gave the commencement speech, which Herman Cain was there. Herman Cain told us that there were three people that influenced him, and his dad, a math teacher, and Benjamin Mays were the most important influences in his life.
Wow.
And it was pretty neat to, on the air, put those dots to connect those dots together, because Herman Cain had no idea of the conversation and where this was coming from.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was very cool.
Dr. Mays is just an amazing man. We were discussing it at an event, and you know, the only way to describe him, this is a human being with a titanium backbone. And there just aren't a lot of folks in the world who have the kind of courage and resolve that Dr. Mays had in a time where having such courage and resolve often got you killed.
Yes, that's true. I thought it was amazing. I mean, just a couple of quick facts is that he went to Bates College in Maine. Mm-hmm. A black man from South Carolina went to Bates College in Maine. Phenomenal.
Well, it was the only white school that would allow him in at the time, and he wanted to go. And if you read his book, he's very clear on this. You know, I want to be really careful how I express this, but you know, he grew up in a society that told him your race makes you less than, and he knew better. You know, I mean, imagine
that—right,
where your entire society is telling you this horrible, horrible lie, and you utterly refuse to believe it. Most people don't have that kind of intellect, don't have that kind of resolve, and yet he was able to do this, and he wanted to prove that by going to school with other white students, which was
taboo.
literally illegal in a lot of places at the time, and you know, if not illegal, taboo, and simply not allowed. And so he, you know, he found a place that would allow him to do that, and of course, you know, proved that he was more the intellect than most of those students, which was, you know, something that the culture needed to learn.
Sure.
You know, most of the people had been hearing those lies from birth, and so they believed them, white and black, believed these lies. And you needed examples like Dr. Mays to go out and prove in unequivocal terms that this is nonsense and that we can't continue to think this way. We can't continue to allow people to tell these lies.
Absolutely. I'm actually from Maine, and actually Bates College was like a half hour from where I lived.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those things where you go, what is this? Yeah, so that was pretty cool. Lots of cool things about Benjamin Mays. And, of course, right now they are trying to get a section of road named the Benjamin Mays Highway. That's what they're working on right now. So I'm sure we'll hear more about Benjamin Mays, and I think that's exciting to have that connection right here in Greenwood 96 McCormick area.
Yeah, a great legacy for the community.
Absolutely. So you've written that play, and someday we'll have somebody here that will perform, will direct and perform in it, and we'll see the whole picture come to life.
Oh, yeah. I look forward to that.
Absolutely. That's terrific. Now, though, but one of the things we did want to talk about is a couple of your plays have been performed on the state stage.
The South Carolina Theater Association Community Theater Festival, which is obviously a mouthful.
Right.
Yes, we took first we took Ask Me Anything, which was my first full-length show. We performed at Greenwood Community Theater and had a really wonderful response to that show. And so Bess Park, who was executive director of the theater at that time, wanted to know if I would take it to South Carolina Theater Association, and we did. And that went very well. We did not win the festival that year. I was given an award for playwriting that year that they created because of the play. I was very proud of that, very pleased. And so I think we didn't win because of my poor directing skills at the end of the day.
But you got better.
I say that. I want to you know, make clear that I feel like my cast made up for a lot of that. But ultimately, there were some things that I learned from the judges that have made me a much better director. And so that was a really great experience. But we went back the following year with Stitches and were able to win the festival that year, last year, last November, and then take the show to the Southeastern Theater Conference Community Theater Festival and represent the state of South Carolina there this past March, which was a great experience as well.
Absolutely. So, and how did you do? In the end, how'd you
well,
do?
Well, we did not advance to nationals, which is essentially the way it's set up. There's no there's no first, second, or third placing, that sort of thing. They merely come out and tell you these are the two shows that are advancing. That's as far as you go. And so that did not happen for
us. So they don't even tell you if you're close?
No, they don't do that. They don't even tell you which of the two that's advancing was number one and which was number two.
Okay.
Although I think we all knew that the one of the performances was a performance of Tuesdays with Maury, and the gentlemen that were doing it was just a two-man show, the version that they did. The gentlemen that were doing that blew everybody away. It was astonishing, and so I did not feel a bit bad about seeing them go on to nationals. They were absolutely incredible, particularly the man who played Maury was just mind-blowing, just amazing. So I didn't feel insulted at all
that
they went ahead of us. But the audience response was wonderful to the show. You know, they laughed where they're supposed to laugh. They cried where they're supposed to cry. And so it was a wonderful experience, and I love my cast, the folks that went
with us. Who
was
in the play?
Let's see. Graham Schaefer was our lead and did a wonderful job for us. He's a great young guy. I don't know if folks know who Graham Schaefer is, but he's Myra Schaefer's son, who know who Miss Myra is. And he's a wonderful actor and actually a really good tech guy. He helped us a lot with that stuff, too. A lot of the things that I don't know how to do, Graham was able to help us do. Randy Walentius was in the show. The group that went, we had a couple of different castings for that show, different performances and who could go and who couldn't. But the group that actually went, the rest of the class was a guy named Kyle Carson, who's a good friend of mine, does not live here but was able to make the trip with us. I unfortunately had to be in the show. I don't like directing myself, but it was a necessity of the travel cast.
Sure. That's tough to do, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. Wally Dorn, I think a lot of folks around here know Wally from the theater, was also in the show and did a wonderful job. And then Bess Park was also in the show, had a small role.
So good cast
there.
That
was our traveling cast. Yes, a wonderful cast, wonderful cast. I can't communicate how honored I am by the people who've chosen to do my work.
Well, that's terrific. Now, because of this experience, though, you're writing a play, right, about the theater competitions?
That is the next project. Well, I'm finishing up these revisions.
Right.
I've been working on this novel.
Right.
Something with a Happy Ending is actually the name of the novel that I'm trying to finish up. But as soon as that's ready, I am diving into a project that we're tentatively calling Adjudicate This. If you're not familiar with theater competitions, they don't call it judging. It's adjudication. You have an adjudication. And while those three theater competition experiences were wonderful, and I don't mean to disparage them in any way, it is sort of a quirky, strange process. And there's a lot of sort of absurdity there that I intend to spoof in a play that we're calling Adjudicate This. Primarily grew out of conversations with Randy Balintius and Graham Schaefer while we were traveling. And ultimately decided that this needed to happen.
This is
absurd. We need to make this play. And so that's my next major project. I'll be trying to knock out a first draft.
Absolutely. That's very cool. Hey, you know, you're listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Yes, I'm Ann Eller. Yes, I've had Chris Allen here with us this afternoon talking about his plays, talking about English, talking about the state of the English language, social media. Yes, we've talked about it all right here on WCRS. Chris Allen, thanks so much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. This was great. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.